The system of life on planet Earth is so astoundingly complex that it was a long time before man even realized that it was a system at all and that it wasn't just something that was there. To understand how anything very complex works, or even to know that there is something complex at work, man needs to see little tiny bits of it at a time. And this is why small islands have been so important to our understanding of life. On the Galapagos Islands, for instance, animals and plants which shared the same ancestors began to change in different ways, once separated from each other by a few miles of water. And this gave us a massive hint about the idea of evolution. The island of Mauritius gave us an equally important but more somber idea, extinction. Until 1682, when Dutch settlers hunted the dodo to extinction, man had no idea that an animal could just cease to exist. It was as if we hadn't realized that if we kill something, it simply won't be there anymore, ever. Islands are fragile. Their wildlife populations are small and usually unique, and when man arrives, he usually creates havoc. Not just because of what he does, but because of what he brings with him. Whole species have been wiped out by cats, pigs, goats, and so on. And there's virtually no land mass left on Earth where the wildlife has not been devastated by one simple animal, the ship's rat. There is, however, one. It's called Round Island. It's just off the coast of Mauritius. It's very small, and although it appears to be almost barren, it has more unique species of animals and plants than any comparable area on Earth. The simple reason for this is that it's very hard for anybody to land on the island at all, let alone with a pig. Mark Cawardine and Douglas Adams have joined a party of people attempting to visit Round Island.
Don't be afraid to get wet.
Here?
Not too tight, not too tight.
No.
Come in. I'll hold you. Jump!
And hang on to the rope. Just hang on to anything.
Give me your hand.
So everything is fine.
Made it. I've just managed to climb ashore. We had to do as we expected. Wait until the wave is high enough to climb onto the rock. And by the time I got here, there were a number of people already standing on the rock with ropes and ready to grab my hand. But even then, it was really difficult. And the rock's very slippery. I noticed a number of people have got cut legs, obviously fallen on the rock as they climbed ashore. So there's one person left, and it's Douglas. And everyone's waiting here to see how he gets on.
Mark and Douglas have, in fact, come to the Indian Ocean in search of the world's rarest fruit bat, which is to be found on the island of Rodrigues, not on Round Island at all. However, the neighbouring islands of Mauritius, Rodrigues and Round Island all originally shared much of the same wildlife, and of the three, only Round Island has escaped being changed out of all recognition by man. Furthermore, Mark and Douglas have been told that the Rodrigues fruit bat, rare as it is in fact ridiculously easy to find. You just go to Rodrigues and there it is. So they're visiting Round Island partly to see one of these islands in its pristine state, but also because they feel that an expedition shouldn't be quite that simple.
We've decided at this late stage that landing where we were is too difficult, so we're experimenting with Douglas. And he's going to land on the other side of the rock, which is much, much steeper, but less slippery. Someone's just dropped into the sea to hold the boat, because the biggest danger is that the boat's going to be bashed against the side of the rocks.
If it's cut under the ledge and the swell comes up, it's turning off.
Yeah. Okay.
Up top.
It looks terribly dodgy. It'll be all right now.
Jump, I'll hold you.
So grab the rope, Douglas. Grab the rope. Oh no, he's misjudged it. He's got the rope, but he's slipping down.
Wait for the water, it's coming.
Wait. Hold on. Hold on to the rope.
Ready?
Okay. Douglas has fallen in. He's slid down on the rock. He's at the moment waist deep in the water, holding onto the rope, and we're all pulling him up.
There we are.
Gently. Gently. Terribly slippery piece of rock.
Hey, right. Who's got the dinghy?
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Just wait. Yeah?
Yeah, I'm fine. No, I'm just glad to be off the boat. I feel vaguely human again now.
Well, it's taken us ages to get up to near the top of the island. We've been scrabbling over lots of bare rocks and dried palm leaves and so on. And we're now on a much more level path, going on a gentle slope up to the very top. Although Round Island's very small, it's actually one of the most important islands for its size anywhere in the world. And it's important because in many ways, it's like Mauritius was 300 or 400 years ago. The collection of animals and plants here are representative of species that have become extinct on the mainland. There's a skink called the telfair skink, for example, which is a kind of lizard that looks as if it's been trodden on. And there's a gecko and two species of snakes and so on. And all these animals survive on Round Island, but they're found literally nowhere else in the world.
Who on earth gets to name these islands? Here is one of the most amazing islands in the world. It looks utterly extraordinary. It's as if the moon itself is rising from the sea. And though it seems dusty and barren when you first look at it, all the craters are full of extraordinary birds and geckos, and there are palm trees that are shaped like Chianti bottles. It's got a coastline that tries to kill you. I mean, you'd think that if you had to name an island like this, you'd get a couple of friends round, get a bottle of wine, and make an evening of it. I mean, not just say, oh, it looks a bit round, let's call it Round Island. From here, you can see another island a few miles away, which is a little bit flat. And guess what they've called that? Flat Island.
We've walked to the highest point on the island, and we're now standing on the edge of an enormous semicircular cliff which drops about 1,000 feet from us here all the way down to the sea below. And up on the top, enormous numbers of ledges and various cracks and nooks in the rocks, and lots of miniature little caves which are about 2 or 3 feet wide and 3 or 4 feet deep. And they're ideal nesting places for white-tailed tropic birds. And as I'm talking now, there are enormous numbers of these tropic birds all around me, sometimes coming to the within just 2 or 3 feet of my head. And they're using the wind as it comes in off the sea to glide, so they don't actually have to flap their wings for hours on end. And right by my feet here, inside one of these miniature caves, is a young tropic bird. If we just approach closely, I think it'll probably call and warn us to stay away. We're about 4 feet away from it at the moment, sitting tight. Beautiful bird, it's about the size of a chicken with a pure white front and underside and a jet black bill and black and white mottled feathers on the top. It's looking very wary at the moment. Hello. Hello. Ooh. Fluffing up his feathers a little bit. He's not going to say a word now. Ooh.
Couple of words that naturalists use a lot when they're on islands: endemic and exotic. An endemic species is one that's native to an island or region and is found nowhere else at all. An exotic species is one that's been introduced from abroad, and these can be very disruptive to an island ecology. A species that has learnt to survive on a large continental landmass, where there are hundreds of thousands of species competing for survival, is a pretty tough species. Introduce it to a small island where the competition is much less fierce, and it tends to barge in and take the place over. One of the wildest and most exotic life forms on Mauritius is, in fact, a Welshman called Carl Jones. 10 years ago, he barged into Mauritius and took over wildlife conservation there. He can't understand why on earth Mark and Douglas should have come all this way to see what he called a boring old Rodrigues fruit bat when they could be finding out about Mauritius.
People come to Mauritius today because they think that it's a paradise. They say, well, it's a beautiful paradise island in the Indian Ocean where you can sit on nice white beaches and get a nice suntan. But of course, what's left of Mauritius is just a mere shadow of what it was like when the first people arrived here. Some of the best, very early accounts that we have come from about 1600 or thereabouts. The Dutch used to be able to run along the beach and jump from tortoise to tortoise without ever having to touch the ground, which suggests there was massive herds that used to go down through the coast, and they got eaten to extinction. And when the first Dutch came and settled on this island, they were probably greeted on the beaches by dodos. We think it was a large flightless pigeon. Although the Dutch describe it in not very complimentary terms and say that you had to boil it a great deal if it was edible and it was very, very fatty. A number of other people describe the dodo as being very fleet-footed and very difficult to catch and being very lean. And somehow it doesn't make sense. But if you look at it in biological terms, you find that the dodo had a fat cycle and that at one time of the year it was very, very fat and sort of waddled around. Another time of the year it was very, very thin. And this fits in with the seasons on Mauritius. The image you get when you read Alice in Wonderland is that it was a rather stupid sort of fat, grotesque turkey-sized creature that sort of waddled around. And this isn't quite true.
Ten years ago, it was decided that the Mauritius kestrel, like the dodo, was doomed to extinction and that there was no point in expending any more effort on it. Carl Jones was given the job of going to Mauritius to close down the small project working to save it. And this is a job he has spectacularly failed to do. He even failed not to set up a breeding centre for rearing kestrels in captivity and releasing them into the wild. This is a particularly difficult thing to fail not to do, and he's been helped in this by several dedicated field workers like Richard Lewis.
Home sweet home. Mauritius kestrels, rarest falcon in the world, only found on the island of Mauritius. 10 years ago, it was down to 6 individuals. Now, a total world population, captive and wild, of about 70 to 80 birds. Now, that was a bit of courtship. Now, that's the male on the left with the food. And the female... female's large. Yeah, that's a chip. And courtship for birds of prey, the male feeds the female. Oh. But this is early courtship, and he's not sure whether he should feed or whether he wants the food himself. And she wants the food. The big problem we get with kestrel pairings...
So courtship at the moment is playing hard to get.
Yeah.
Food.
Yeah. Still early days. Females are bigger than males, and they beat up the males. And you end up with males with inferiority complexes. comes to the breeding season, the female turns on sexy. She's, come and get it. And the male goes, no chance. I know what happened last time.
Yeah.
He goes to the other end of the aviary. He won't budge.
That's funny. Yeah.
Pink's on his own. Pink was one of the first kestrels ever raised in captivity. He was raised on his own, So he thinks he's a human, not a kestrel. No. So you can't put him with a female kestrel, he wouldn't do anything.
Wouldn't know what to do.
But he loves Carl. I mean, Carl walks in here, Pink goes crazy, you know, he'd love to just get a hold of Carl.
Come on! Come on! They can't be very hungry, can they?
The purpose of the breeding centre is, of course, to release the birds into the wild. Carl Jones regularly goes out into the gorges of Mauritius to see how his kestrels are fending for themselves.
But what she does, she goes into juvenile behaviour and she solicits food. She shows all the juvenile behaviours of calling and flapping her wings and so on. Mm. And the male goes out and hunts for her. If he doesn't bring back enough, obviously she's got to do some of her own hunting. Mm. But what we do, you see, is we feed them a mouse or two or three mice, and that's a super stimulus. And once she gets a few mice, she thinks, God, it's great around here. This is a good male. He's feeding me very well. And she just settles down and lays her eggs. But if you feed too many mice, she'll just keep on laying. And after she's hatched one lot of eggs and she's got some youngsters, she'll go off somewhere else and lay a second clutch of eggs. And by feeding too much, we've had four clutches of eggs a year, which isn't what we're about, because the more eggs you get, obviously the greater chance of rearing lots of babies, but the egg quality drops down, so you've got to try and...
The egg quality drops down?
Yes. Oh. It's all very technical, you know.
Highly complex.
Yeah, it's taken us many years to actually work it all out. Okay, should come out.
Right.
We're now in lowland forest. And this is actually quite a nice patch of lowland forest, although it isn't very big. But there are some very interesting species here. And there are some species in this valley that are found nowhere else in the world. And these dark trunk trees, these are black ebony trees. It's a very famous tree, and it's the reason why the Dutch first came here and colonized this island. They came here for the ebonies. Now, if we go up and find ourselves an ebony tree, feel that. That's pretty hard, isn't it? Ouch. They're very dense trees. We don't know how long it takes to grow, but perhaps that might be, 200 years old or something.
These black ebonies are very elegant, aren't they? They're very sort of tall, slim, straight trees.
Yes, and...
You have to look quite far up before they start to branch out. What area of Mauritius is now covered in native forest, if it was completely covered a few hundred years ago? What sort of amount has disappeared?
Areas of very good forest left is probably 1% or less, which is a sobering thought.
1% or less?
Of really good native forest. Let's go and look for some other trees.
We've finally got to Rodrigues, in a small twin otter plane. Until very recently, we would have had to get the boat, which would have been a problem because the timetable was simply the captain's whim, and we could have been stranded here for a month or so. It's a small island, only 42 square miles, but it's fantastically crowded. 30,000 people live here. They mostly live by subsistence agriculture, which means that there has been a lot of forest clearance, and the forest, of course, is the home of the bats. The remaining forest is now protected in order to prevent erosion of the hillsides and preserve the watersheds, and thus a continuing supply of fresh water on the island. Today, when the evening begins to fall, we will go and search the forest for bats. It looks as if it might be much more difficult than we've been led to believe.
It's so calm. We're sitting here facing the sea and you can't even feel a sea breeze. It's hard to believe that Rodrigues is right in the middle of a major cyclone belt. And this is one of the biggest problems facing the fruit bats, because although over the years they've been killed for food and they've suffered from habitat destruction and so on, when a cyclone hits the island, they all get torn off their perches and blown out to sea. Or even if they manage to survive that, they have nothing to eat because all the fruit gets stripped from the trees and so they starve to death. When the last cyclone hit the island, or the last major one in 1979, it killed virtually the entire bat population, and they reckon that maybe only 60 or 70 of them managed to survive. Well, there haven't been any major cyclones here in the last 10 or 15 years, and the population's managed to build up a bit more once again. No one's exactly sure how many there are, but it's probably in the region of 800 or 1,000.
We've now got about 2 hours in which to find this creature that we've come all this way to look for. And we're on our own this time.
Yeah, this is how it should be. We've had it too easy up until now. We've been shown everything, haven't had to work for ourselves. So this is the real test. If we fail to find them now, then...
We may as well pack up and go home. Of course, if we do find one now, we can also pack up and go home.
Correct.
In fact, on a small island with 30,000 people on it, it's very hard to be on your own for very long, even in the forest. Just as Mark and Douglas were getting completely lost, they were lucky enough to encounter a small, French-speaking Chinese bat location expert.
Dense and rocky.
Yeah. It's better for you to keep an arrangement with the senior forest officer.
Is it very far to the bats?
Yeah, very, very far indeed.
To the bats?
Yes.
Yeah?
Oh.
Well, we're determined. Where are the bats?
About 1 mile.
From here?
Yeah. And then... You want to go?
Yeah.
I'll keep it, I'll meet you somewhere.
Try to follow the Chinaman down a vague sort of path. It's incredibly muddy and slippery, and he's shot off ahead, so it's very difficult to keep up with him. There's all this vegetation on either side, and all these branches and leaves and so on are soaking wet. I'm soaked through to the skin. But we'd never have found the bats on our own. Just impossible. And you can't see anything, but you can definitely hear some sort of noise off in the distance, the chirping and twittering of them. So he must be getting quite close.
Oh,
just surrounded in thousands of mosquitoes, all biting. Well, we're frantically spraying mosquito spray all over us. It doesn't seem to be having too much effect. I'm just covered, my whole leg's covered in dead mosquitoes and bits of blood.
Can I leave you?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much.
Nice to meet you.
Can we?
We would never have found this, would we, if we'd been on our own again?
No. Oh, yes. There they are.
There.
It's very difficult at any point to say, right, there is a fruit bat, you can see one. On the other hand, you are aware of them fluttering backwards and forwards, just sort of beyond the leaf cover. So you just get a sort of sensation of one flitting past, another flitting past. You never actually see one outright.
They're just so tantalisingly just beyond where you can get a good look of them.
They're flying about 10 yards away from us. Oh, you can just see a couple over here quite clearly. There's quite a nice big gap in the leaves, which the bats have probably pulled all the leaves and branches off themselves, because they often like to weed around their favourite roost so they can see one another and keep a check on the colony. There's quite a few bats flying overhead, as you can see through the gap. One of them's just stretched out its wing. It's hanging upside down. You can see a gaping hole in the middle of the wing. Probably got that from a fight with another bat, or maybe scagged it on a branch or something while it was feeding up in the trees. Doesn't seem to affect their flight at all, because a lot of the others flying overhead have also got holes and various cuts and things. They look so different to bats at home, nothing like vampire bats or any of ours in Britain. So they've got these amazing fox-like faces. And when they... Oh, yeah, this one of them's just moved a little bit into the light. It's got the most amazing golden coloured fur. And they're often called golden bats or flying foxes because they look so different to all the other bats.
And meanwhile, our blood is being sucked by mosquitoes.
The following day, Wendy Strahm, one of the field researchers from Mauritius, arrived here to do, she said brightly, a bat count. This surprised us. How do you count bats in the forest when you can hardly see them? She explained to us, rather patiently, I thought, that you go into the forest to see where the bats live. But if you want to count them, you have to go somewhere where you can actually see them flying over you. And there was a much, much simpler place to do that.
What we usually do is we come up to this place, and the bats, as they come out of Cascade Pigeon, cross the road, so they're very easy to count. But whenever there's a stiff wind like there is now, they're flying backwards again.
Flying in all directions.
They're flying. Oh, yeah, this isn't any good. I think it's not going to be very useful.
This is the most absurd place to come to watch an endangered species. We've come all this way to a tiny island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and this is the most endangered fruit bat in the world. And here we are standing next to the main road running across the spine of the island and in front of the local shop.
Anybody want a drink? Beer? <huh? laughs>
We're supposed to be doing field work. Now the night time, we can't see the bats anymore.
Yes, it was a complete muck-up.
We should have arrived a little bit earlier, and the wind should have been blowing a little bit less.
Yeah.
And then we shouldn't have been talking so much, and we shouldn't have had our beer, and then we might have got a few more bats.
Other than that, it was a great success.
The Rodrigues fruit bat is successfully pulling itself back from the edge of extinction, not through any direct intervention on its behalf, but because man has realized that he needs to maintain the forest for his own welfare. Round Island has remained relatively undamaged because it's just too difficult for man even to get onto the place. Mauritius, however, has been wrecked almost beyond all recognition by man's presence on the island. It's only through the determined intervention of extraordinary people like Carl Jones and his colleagues that people in the future will have any chance of standing in an open space, looking up into the sky, watching the birds or bats flying over, flying over, and counting.